From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Tales of White Mountains, search and rescue usually focus on the people who run into trouble, how it happened, the decisions they made, the factors they faced, and whether their story had a happy ending. But what about the rescuers, those hardy souls, mostly volunteers, who brave the elements and come find you? Today in The Exchange, we hear their side of the story through a new book called Critical Hours. It presents the details of incidents and responses over the years as it wrestles with a larger issue, a rise in what the author calls an alarming overconfidence out on our trails. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or call in 1-800-892-6477. We have two guests in studio. Samantha Brady is here, president of Androscoggin Valley Search and Rescue and manager of museum and retail operations at the Mount Washington Observatory. And Samantha, thank you for making the trip. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Also with us, Sandy Stott, author of the book I mentioned, Critical Hours, Search and Rescue in the White Mountains. He's former editor and writer for the Appalachian Mountain Club's journal, Appalachia. And for the last 5 years, he's been the journal's accidents editor. And Sandy, thank you also for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So, Sandy, right at the back cover of this book, before you even crack it open, you talk about the alarming levels of overconfidence out on the trails in recent years. What do you mean by that, Sandy?
It has to do with the accessibility of the White Mountains. We are within driving distance for 80 million people. They can get here in a day, and people think that walking in the mountains is similar to walking on a street. And so often they simply pull up at a trailhead, they walk between two trees, and they start walking off into the woods. Sometimes they start with a full pack, and sometimes they start with a trail map. But often they'll start simply walking and assume that they'll turn around and come back at some point. And most of them do, but occasionally they don't. And often it's because they have no idea where they're going or what equipment they'll need to get there.
Well, and that's been the case for a long time, that we're in close proximity to a lot of people and that, you know, a lot of people don't make the best of plans. But what's changed, Sandy? Because from the book, I gather that you have seen increasing levels of this overconfidence in recent years.
I think part of what's changed is that people are looking at the mountains as a more extreme playground. So people are taking risks and going to parts of the mountains that they didn't used to visit or that were visited very infrequently, and more people are going to extremes. And so I think that you have the people who get in trouble because they have no experience, but you also have a subset of people who have a lot of experience but are taking risks that weren't being taken 20 years ago.
And why is that? What do you think?
I think people love to push boundaries, and they are looking for adventures that they haven't had before. It was interesting. I just read a piece in The Atlantic the other day, and it was about a spate of deaths on Capitol Peak in Colorado. And that spate of deaths all happened on a ridge that leads up to one of their 14,000-foot mountains. That had been popularized on social media. And so people saw other people going across this ridge and then finishing by saying something like, I crushed it. And people began to think, well, I could do that too. And so I think there's more access to the images and the experiences that other people are having and that will draw people to take chances or push boundaries.
Yeah, I saw that article. 5 deaths in, I think, 6 weeks
in
that
weeks.
Exact same Instagram-worthy spot. Samantha, I wonder what you see of this alarming overconfidence, to use Sandy's words.
I'd have to say that I definitely agree with a lot of what Sandy is saying. You definitely see, especially with social media, there are people out there that are seeing those photos and they're definitely using them as, oh, well, it doesn't look that hard, or it looks like it's something I'm capable of doing because so many other people are doing it. And social media, in my opinion, is definitely being used to help people get encouraged to want to go out and try new things and do things they've never done before. And it's almost something that you can't really explain to people through social media. It's an experience that has to be done and experienced yourself to understand how hard or how difficult the level of a trail is, because everybody has different levels of difficulty in their own personal experiences. So I would have to agree that a lot of that is very much people using what they see on social media. And Sandy, you said, you know, they come back and they say they crushed it, which makes it seem as though it wasn't that hard or difficult or complicated, or that they didn't run into any issues during their crushing it, so to speak. So I think that definitely plays a huge part.
It's two sides of a coin, though, isn't it, Samantha? I mean, on the one hand, it's great that social media is encouraging people to get out. We have an epidemic of obesity in this country. Philosophers talk about nature deficit disorder among kids. So on one hand, it's great that social media is saying, hey, this is really cool and really beautiful. You should get out and see it, too.
Absolutely. And I agree with that 100%. There are always two sides to the social media aspect to it. There's obviously the educational part that, you know, you want people to understand what's out there, what your opportunities are. You also want organizations who are out there educating the general public of what the trail conditions are like, et cetera. But then you also have the side effects for the pros, and then the other sides are the cons. And the cons are, you know, people who are just saying, well, this trail is easy, yet you've never hiked in the White Mountains, so how do you know what easy actually is, or how do you define easy, moderate, difficult, things like that? And then you have the other teams like the Appalachian Mountain Club, who do a great job at educating, you know, what their trails are. There are many books written about the types of terrain throughout the entire White Mountains and what to expect when you're on those trails. So social media plays both sides all the time.
Well, and so we're talking about social media and its impact on people exploring the White Mountains, taking maybe unnecessary risks in the White Mountains. Another form of technology that we've talked about for a number of years now, Sandy, is, you know, cell phones, smartphones, tracking devices. How do those affect people's assessment of risk in the White Mountains?
They have a profound influence on people's assessment of risk, I think, in that when you can be in touch almost instantaneously, the illusion that you nurse when you're off in the mountains is that help also may be available almost instantaneously, and it's not. Samantha and I were talking in the beginning about how long it takes for her to get to the beginning of a rescue, and often it takes a rescue team 4 hours, 6 hours, 8 hours to reach someone. So I think the instant nature of the communication creates an illusion that has caused trouble. Rescuers I've talked to have also felt they have mixed feelings about the ability to call from the backcountry. It has saved lives. It's saved people in the past, because in the past they would have been left on their own, and somebody would have either had to find them after they went missing, or it would have taken much more time. On the other hand, people will often call for trivial reasons.
Such as?
Oh, it's New Hampshire Fish and Game, which oversees search and rescue in the state, sends me their official reports. And, you know, people get tired and they think they'll call to have somebody come help them get out. Or people...
Because I'm tired.
Because I'm tired. Or because I think I'm lost and I haven't taken time to try to figure out where the trail is or how I got off the trail. So I think that instant communication also, people pick up the phone sometimes as if they're simply calling to get information, and but they will call for help. So it's a mixed blessing.
What do you think, Samantha?
I will definitely agree it's a mixed blessing. I will say in the past few years we've done quite a bit of training, mostly through New Hampshire Outdoor Council. They put on a spring training every May. And for the last, I'd probably say 3 years, we've been really focused on technology in the backcountry and the pros and the cons. And again, everything has a pro and a con to it. GPS devices. We've gone back and forth whether or not, you know, spot devices, are those good for people who are going out in the backcountry who are replacing their map and their compass with, you know, GPSs. A lot of the times, I think people are purchasing these devices thinking, this is a safety net for me. So worst case, if I get lost, I'll just press a button. Help's on its way. It'll be here shortly. It's not like that, unfortunately.
Well, if it took somebody 5 hours to hike in and then they get lost, it's going to take you 5 hours to get there, too.
Yeah, typically we like to tell people, I like to tell people especially, if it took you 5 hours, it's going to take double the amount of time because we're full-time employees elsewhere at a job. We're just volunteer rescuers, so we have to report. Well, New Hampshire Fish and Game has to get the phone call first, and they usually are dispatched through someone else. So by the time someone is called for help, that person is dispatched to New Hampshire Fish and Game, and then New Hampshire Fish and Game has decided to dispatch all of the volunteer rescue teams that are necessary. Then the calls go out to the volunteers. So it's a multitude of things that happen leading up to us finally getting the call, getting our stuff together in our cars, you know, whether we have a ready pack or not, or getting back to our houses to get our stuff to then go meet. It's usually, like Sandy was saying, it's 4 or 5 hours before we even get to a person. So you might only be an hour hike in. We might be 4 or 5 hours away from getting to you.
And I read in Sandy's book that some of these rescuers, you know, there's this image of you all sort of live right there, you know, next door to the trailhead. But some live in Massachusetts. I know one guy who lives in Concord. I mean, people are coming from all over the region to assist with these rescues.
Yep. So I can speak for Androscoggin Valley Search and Rescue. We try and make sure that our applicants are somewhat within the vicinity, at least 45 minutes to our location, which is Androscoggin Valley. There's also Pemi Valley Search and Rescue. So I'm not sure how they kind of make sure their members or part of that team are close enough to a call.
But each group is different. Yeah.
Yeah. So we want to make sure that we have people who can respond in a timely manner because it is sometimes, you know, it's an emergency in some cases. So you want to make sure that you can get there as quickly as possible and have all the gear needed to be out there for however long they expect you to be out there for.
I have so many more questions for both of you, but I want to remind our listeners that you can join our conversation too. The number here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the Exchange, Critical Hours, Search and Rescue in the White Mountains. That's the title of a new book which offers a history and a celebration of the search and rescue teams who save lives in the Whites. The book also reflects on changes, though, as we're hearing from our guests, in how the public approaches the great outdoors, including what the author calls an alarming rise in overconfidence out on the trails. Let's hear from you. What have you seen in the Whites? What have you experienced yourself in the White Mountains in terms of this topic? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So, Sandy, one of the many hats that you've worn is editing the accident reports for Appalachia, the AMC's journal. What mistakes or decisions, Sandy, do you see over and over and over again?
The mistake of starting a hike too late and not having a headlamp is probably the chronic problem that
really it's so simple.
It's very simple, but getting started late, not knowing exactly how long the hike is going to take, and getting benighted, so being out at night without a headlamp, is probably the most common rescue that New Hampshire Fish and Game is asked to undertake, and that they'll often ask the volunteers to help with that if they have too much going on. The other rescues that are very common are slips and falls, and
which anyone can do,
and so it can be somebody who's inexperienced. It could be me. I've been hiking in the mountains for over 60 years. One of the factors, it's an interesting subtlety that is true now, is that more and more people are hiking with running shoes or walking shoes, and those shoes have a tread that isn't as doesn't have as much friction as boots do. But I think the main factor is they wear out really quickly. And so you're always replacing your footwear, and therefore you don't know the soles of your feet the way you used to with boots that lasted 10 years. Yeah, you know, I knew exactly what they would hold on and exactly when I'd slip.
So more people are hiking just in sneakers or trail running shoes that aren't those sort of heavy, sturdy hiking boots, although sort of a little bit guilty as charged. I wouldn't do Lincoln Lafayette in sneakers, but, you know, hiking boots are heavy and they kind of rub your ankle and, you know.
No question. And I will be the last. I'm guilty as charged as well. I hike almost and run almost exclusively in running shoes now. And I still have an old pair of Limmer boots, which were the sort of iconic boots of the White Mountains, but I only wear them for sentimental reasons.
What other sort of basics do you see, Samantha, in terms of, you know, oh, that's a mistake I've seen time and time again. So starting out late, no headlamp. What else do you see?
Mostly, it's the preparedness in situations that I've been on. Most of the calls I've actually been on are slips and falls, you know, broken limbs, ankles, lower leg injuries. And I think a lot of it is, Sandy and I were sort of having a conversation just before this about the preparedness of people, and what I carry as a rescuer is usually sometimes double or triple the amount of food and water when I go out on a call. And most situations that I've been in, I have found that the person who is injured, the patient, is very thirsty and very hungry typically when they're in a litter and they're being carried out, because no one plans to spend 15, 18 hours, you know, in a litter or in the woods, and they're only preparing for what they think they're going to be out for the day. So for me, it's just making sure that you have, you know, the extra warm clothing that you might not typically bring, because at the end of the day, you know, if you're only planning to be out from daylight to daylight and you end up out there until midnight or one in the morning, temperatures, they drop, and they drop fast. So knowing and understanding that you need to always prepare yourself for the worst case scenario, and also just having that understanding of weather changes so drastically and so quickly in the mountains. You might think it's a beautiful day because it's 60 in the higher summits all day and sunny, but at the end of the night, it might change.
I'm guessing weather misjudgment is a major factor in a lot of these rescues that you do.
Yes, I would assume that there are quite a few people that go out there, and I see it mostly just from working on Mount Washington a lot of the time. People have this misconception that it's 80, 90 degrees in the valley, it's going to be 80 and 90 degrees on the summit, and that's not the case.
Not at all, especially on Mount Washington. No. With the winds up there. Go ahead.
You know, I've actually had people come to me working on the summit and ask, you know, I thought it was going to be warmer up here because we're closer to the sun. So it's having people understand that whole, you know, it's the higher up you get, the colder it's going to be, and just being prepared for worst case scenario.
The sun is 93 million some odd miles away, so being a little bit closer on top of Mount Washington, hard to imagine, but we'll let that sit for the moment. So lots more to talk about after a short break, including why people involved in search and rescue do this work. It's difficult, it's unpaid, it's dangerous. We'll talk about that coming up after a short break. And we'll hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, New Hampshire search and rescue teams, who they are, the decisions they make, and what they're seeing out there on our trails these days, especially as technology leads to a rise in overconfidence by some hikers. Let's get you into our conversation. What have you seen when hiking in the White Mountains? What mistakes have you made yourself, or what mistakes have you seen others make when hiking? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. 8928-892-NHPR. With me in studio, Samantha Brady, president of Androscoggin Valley Search and Rescue, manager of the museum and retail operations at the Mount Washington Observatory. Sandy Stott is here. He's author of the book we're looking at, Critical Hours, Search and Rescue in the White Mountains. He's a former editor and writer for the Appalachian Mountain Club's journal, Appalachia. And for the last 5 years, he's been the journal's accident editor. One more time, that number for you to call us, 1-800-892-6477. And both of you, let's go to our listeners. And Hillary's calling from Merrimack. Hi, Hillary. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Laura. Thank you so much for taking my call and covering this topic today.
Sure.
My question for the panel is, for somebody who is a newer hiker, what are some of the educational resources available to us so that we do not get ourselves in trouble?
Hillary, thanks for calling. And go ahead, Samantha, on that.
I will definitely say, as an avid hiker, one of the first places I actually went to was Appalachian Mountain Club. I think it's a really great resource for any sort of education for the backcountry, hiking, educating on what kind of gear you need, 10 essentials. So HikeSafe is another one.
HikeSafe.com. We've got a link on our website to that. Go
perfect.
Ahead.
Yeah. Definitely having those 10 essentials is key, even just in the worst minimal case scenario. And then also the Mount Washington Observatory, so mountwashington.org, where you can find higher summits forecast. I can't express enough how important it is to know higher summits forecast versus a valley forecast. Valley forecast is not going to give you what's going to happen 4,000 feet and higher.
Some members of my family, a couple weeks ago, it was a beautiful day here in Concord. And so everybody said, hey, you know, let's go for a hike. And sure enough, I guess it was early May, there was snow. It was very difficult. People didn't pack crampons. And so it's even for experienced hikers like us, it's hard to realize what is still there.
Yep, exactly.
The advice that you often get, Sandy, from websites like HikeSafe.com and others is, you know, to pack all this stuff. And it's human nature, isn't it, to just say, okay, come on, I'm just going for a day hike. I'm going for a 3-hour hike. I'm not even, you know, going to do a 4,000 footer. Why do I need to bring a sleeping bag? Do you bring a sleeping bag when you go on a day hike?
I do.
You do?
I do, but it's a small one. And frankly, it wouldn't be much good below 50 degrees. But I do have a little bit of shelter with me every time I go out.
What kind of shelter? Like a little tent?
Or I have a drop cloth that would repel water. And I have a small sleeping bag. And I generally bring enough warm clothing so that I could last a night while I'm waiting for Samantha to come get me.
Even if you're doing like Welch Dickey or something, you know, that's a reasonable day hike, but
yeah,
not too crazy.
And actually, specifically if I'm doing something like Welch Dickey, which is a 3-hour hike and it's quick. And those are the times when you're moving along and who knows if you're going to slip and fall, and who knows whether the weather's going to—I mean, I do know whether the weather's going to change within 24 hours, but it's hard to know what's going to happen to you.
Do you want to jump in on that, Samantha? What people bring for just, you know, a quickie day hike.
I will say that I agree. I also either have a sleeping bag or a bivy sack that I carry with me year-round. And I will—one of my favorite pieces that I have is what is called a tarp poncho. So it kind of, you can use it as a poncho, but you can also use it for shelter if you needed to. It's packs down really small. It's really lightweight. So just kind of, sometimes people say, I don't want to spend the money on the gear, but at the end of the day, it's worth it to have it.
If you get stuck.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Hillary, thank you for your excellent question. And let's take Bill in Randolph. Hi, Bill. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. How are you?
Fine.
I just thought I'd check in. I know both Samantha and Sandy pretty well. And I've been involved in search and rescue now for most of my life. I'm 71 years old. And I think a lot of the problems I see is just the attitude that people start out with. They start out to conquer the mountain, particularly Mount Washington. And to me, a better attitude is just to go out with the thought that you're going to have a nice hike today. Maybe you'll get to the top of the mountain, maybe you won't. But I think if you just are going out with the idea that you're going to go for a nice walk, and if the weather turns bad or something goes wrong, gets, you know, the day is getting later, then you just turn around and go home and say, I had a great walk today. I visited some waterfalls I haven't seen before, and all turns out well. Maybe another hike I'll get to the top of the mountain, and maybe I won't.
So, Bill, let's talk about that.
That's a big part.
And I'm glad you called. Let's talk about that, because this happens especially when people are from out of state. There's a lot of headlines about people from Massachusetts and from Canada. And, you know, it's easy to judge, Bill, but they plan. They take, you know, a long weekend from a long weekend off. They arrange childcare. Maybe they have to take time off work. They have all their gear. So it's easy for you or me to say, you know, because we live in New Hampshire, okay, so it didn't work out today. I'll go home. But if you've taken a week off of work and come up from New York City to conquer the whites, quote unquote, it's hard to say turn back.
Yeah, I understand that very much. But you can still come to the White Mountains with the attitude that you're going to go for a hike as opposed to getting to the top of a mountain. And maybe when you get here, you look at your map and you get an up-to-date weather forecast and say, okay, we'll modify our plans for today and we'll do something else. And I worked with the Forest Service for quite a few years patrolling the mountain trails, and I very often would go out on a rainy day and see people heading up towards the top of Mount Madison or Mount Adams or something, and I would suggest to them, look, it's a bad day to be above treeline. It's a great day. It's pouring rain, but it's a great day to stay down low and visit some of these waterfalls, and they're going to be roaring today, and you'll have a great walk. And very often people would take my suggestion, and I'd see them later on, and I'd say, yeah, it was great. The waterfalls were beautiful. And next time we come, maybe the weather will be better.
Well,
I don't know. It just seems like something they have to be willing to modify their plans based on the weather and other factors.
Well, Bill, I'm so glad you called. And Sandy, I wonder what you think about this, the idea that I'm here, I've made all these plans, I've taken time off work, I need to do this.
I think I'd back up to the verb you used in describing that person, and that's the verb conquer. And anytime you come into the mountains to conquer them, A, that's hubris because you're not going to conquer the mountains. They're going to be there long after you are. But the idea that you have to have this achievement as the capstone of your week or your weekend is what gets people to overextend. And I think Bill's absolutely right. You can, if you come to walk and you come to experience the mountains and then you look at the weather and you say, I'll take what the weather is giving me today, and that might be looking at waterfalls as opposed to looking into the fog from the top of a mountain.
And slipping on your way down.
And slipping
because
on
it's
your
wet.
Way down.
Well, and so that idea of I'm here, I'm going to conquer, both of you said earlier, promoted in part by social media, awesome pictures posted by everybody else I want to post too. What about outdoor retailers who want people to buy their gear? You quote, Sandy, in your book, an ad from, I think it was the North Face, miles from nowhere, the unthinkable is the new normal. What responsibility do outdoor retailers bear for sort of encouraging people to push the limits?
I think they bear some responsibility because they are using visuals and they're using pictures and they're using film clips that fill people's minds and short circuit the whole apprenticeship or ladder of experience that you need to get to those places that are extreme. So I think that they're pushing fantasies, as advertisers often are. But,
sure.
That's, you bear some responsibility if you're doing that.
Do you want to jump in on that, Samantha?
That's not something I've ever thought about before, but you're right. It goes back to those beautiful pictures that someone who does live in the city isn't experiencing every day like us who live in the White Mountains, and they want that experience. They want to know what it's like to be on top of a mountain and see a beautiful sunset. And that's what people are reaching for. Is, you make a good point, Sandy, that these outdoor retailers are pushing something that is a fantasy for most people.
The unthinkable is the new normal. I was pretty struck by that. Well, here's an email that came in from Greg in West Ossipee. He says, I periodically work in remote areas, sometimes for several days at a time. I have to prepare for taking care of myself and not expect I have a backup. This thought process dictates how hard I work and how I cross various terrains. If there is a chance of injury, I defer on finding another route as any injury in these settings is a real problem. I often have no ability to communicate outside of a spot transceiver. My spot is used solely to communicate at the end of the day that I am safe or in extreme emergency situations. Greg says, none to date. Others always know where I am working if they hear nothing from me. My most valuable equipment is my brain and its accumulated experiences. My motto, take no chances. Greg, thank you so much for this. And I wonder what you think, Samantha, first of all, of his attitude. And then I have another question for you.
I think it's great. I think that he's right. His brain, his experiences are what are going to make him stay safe in the backcountry. I would not say that having a spot device is something you shouldn't have. I think it's actually great, especially for those who are solo outdoor enthusiasts who spend a lot of time in the backcountry by themselves. However, I think the most important piece is for anyone who purchases a device like that to make sure that they actually take it out of the factory settings, which doesn't often happen.
Oh, I see. Is that another problem that you run into?
Yeah, and I've heard this through New Hampshire Fish and Game during some trainings we've done, and it actually surprised me. But after working in the outdoor retail world, it actually doesn't surprise me. A lot of consumers who purchase these devices, again, it's a safety net, and they just assume when they take it out of the box, it's ready to go. You don't even have to do anything except turn it on and charge it. Unfortunately, that's not the situation. There are GPS coordinates within those devices that need to be calibrated to your exact locations. So if you don't take it out of the factory settings, there's a good chance you might end up on the mountain and you might be lost and you might send a call out and New Hampshire Fish and Game is going to ask you what your coordinates are. And if you're giving them the wrong coordinates, then
they can't find you.
They might not be able to, or they might not be able to get to you fast enough. Or, you know, you have to think about those things when you are purchasing devices like that. But again, it's always having that backup of your experience and your brain and your knowledge of knowing what's best and always having that second option. So a map and a compass.
Well, Greg, thank you for the email. And his email reminds me of a chapter in your book, Sandy, and I want to hear from both of you on this. There's a guy in the book, Sandy, who says New Hampshire's excellent search and rescue teams have encouraged people to take unnecessary risks. And he kind of advocates for no search and rescue. We're on our own. Who is he and what motivates his thinking?
Robert Cruzina is a very experienced climber who is the winner of the top Alpine Award in Canada. So he's somebody who knows where he's going and what to do. His take on rescue is a libertarian take, and it's that the government and the search and rescue function of the government promotes overconfidence or promotes people taking risks because somebody will come get you, and that we are, each of us, is responsible for him or herself. And so his advocacy in that essay, and full disclosure, I published that essay in Appalachia in 1995, and Mr. Cruzina wrote it for me, and those were all his opinions. On the other hand, there was a little tongue-in-cheek in that at times, I thought. But his advocacy for no rescue at all was intended to put the onus back on each of us and say, if you want to go out and do this, that's great. This is a great place to go out. But you go out and you be responsible for yourself.
How do you feel about that?
Every time I read Cruzina's essay, and I've reread it a number of times, I migrate a little bit on the spectrum toward the libertarian side, but I don't get all the way out to saying, let's not have a search and rescue function. I do think that it's really important that we not go from the current setup to a fully professionalized search and rescue system, which would be used at the drop of a hat.
So now it's mostly volunteers. It's you got Fish and Game, but it's mostly volunteers like Samantha.
Right. And what it creates is that there's, because it takes time, there is a certain restraint that's built into our search and rescue scene. And I think if we were professionalized the way they are in Chamonix in France, where essentially there are two rescuers who are sitting in a spare room right next to a helipad, and if you call in for a rescue in Chamonix, they're going to come get you, and they're great. They're among the best rescuers in the world, but it's a different scene.
What do you think about this philosophy that Sandy describes in his book of, you know, our excellent search and rescue infrastructure that you're a part of has in and of itself encouraged people to take unnecessary risks?
I think it kind of plays both sides. Every team is different. I know Androscoggin Valley Search and Rescue, we try and focus on what our mission is, which is really to save lives and lessen suffering and assist with New Hampshire Fish and Game on any search and rescue missions. We really aren't there to educate the public. We're not trying to tell people what they should and shouldn't do, which is really great. It's one of the reasons why I enjoy being part of the team I'm part of, mostly because we want to be there and assist when we can. We don't necessarily want to be the person responsible. New Hampshire Fish and Game does a great job at doing that, but I agree with Sandy where if you make it this paying job, it becomes a different situation for everybody involved, volunteers, and then it definitely gives a different perspective for those who are going out, and they will just go under the assumption that there is always just a phone call away. And I think the perception now is you're a phone call away and you're only an hour away, but realistically that isn't the case. So
as you described earlier.
Yeah. So I don't think in the search and rescue community, you don't want people to just take what they already are seeing as the perception and then saying, well, now these people are getting paid, so they have a job to do. So now come pull me off of a mountain or pluck me off of a mountain. I'm not sure what Chamonix weather is, but I go back to the whole weather thing. For me, it's a really huge important part because we have Mount Washington, which sits 6,288 feet in the atmosphere, where we have some of the most extreme windier days than anywhere else in the world. And we can't just always send out a helicopter and pluck people off mountains. It just doesn't work like that here in New Hampshire. So,
how do you make the decision that it's safe for you guys to go out, Samantha? Because, you know, there was a case where a rescuer died in the process of trying to rescue someone.
So in a situation like that, New Hampshire Fish and Game definitely has in the past called the volunteer teams, and the volunteer teams are allowed to assess the situation and make their decisions. I know that when I first joined in 2012 on Androscoggin Valley Search and Rescue, one of the members actually said to me in a shakedown hike, you are responsible for yourself, and if you feel uncomfortable at any time, any moment, you can turn around, you can walk away from this situation. Don't ever put yourself in risk for someone who's already at risk. So we're pretty free to make that decision and that call, thankfully.
It'd be tough, though.
Mm-hmm. You know? It is.
Because you're in it because your heart and soul wants to save that person.
At the end of the day, you have to realize, though, we're still human and we are volunteers and we are here to help and we want to help. And I think sometimes that mentality goes back and forth depending on the person and how much you actually want to be there and help someone. But what's the reality of actually getting to that person safely?
We'll talk more after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
I've been an NHPR member for just about 20 years, and this year I decided to become a sustaining member.
Nancy DeBosque of Keene.
I think NHPR has tremendous value, and it's local, so I really do like to know what's going on in my state and use that information a lot in my work.
Thousands of listeners like Nancy support NHPR with ongoing monthly contributions, and you can too. Invest in independent local news and become a sustainer today at nhpr.org and click on donate.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup with Peter Biello. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, we're looking at White Mountains Search and Rescue. A new book celebrates the teams that go out and find lost and injured hikers, as it also ponders changes in how the public approaches the great outdoors, especially the role of technology and whether it encourages people to take risks that perhaps they shouldn't take. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. NHPR. And Samantha and Sandy, lots of emails are coming in. So here's one from Susan, who says, I used to think AMC book time was slow. Now in my late 70s, I am glad to be able to hike at that pace. I guess AMC book time Sandy's AMC's estimates of how long it takes you to do a certain hike. Okay. She says, I hike alone a lot around Cardigan, which I know well. But after reading Sandy's book, I'm beginning to think that that's not as wise as it used to be. And maybe I will take a grandchild. I plan to continue hiking Mukshalaki, my favorite mountain, but have to think twice about how my knees will hold up for the 9-mile hike on Franconia Ridge, another favorite place. And Susan, thank you so much for this email, because New Hampshire is an aging state, and we should talk. I'll turn to you first, Samantha, about aging hikers. People say this mountain has never been a problem for me, and lo and behold, you're 62, and all of a sudden it is a problem.
I will say, don't let age affect you. I have avid hiker friends that are in their late 70s, 80s that are still doing full Pemi loops, 32, 34 miles a day.
Wow, that's awesome.
As long as you're healthy and you feel good, then, I mean, some of the things like medical conditions, as far as, you know, that are unexpected, you can't prepare for those. They just happen.
And this also gets to another issue that comes up in Sandy's book, and I'll turn to you first, Samantha. The idea that, again, we're an aging state. Eventually, search and rescue people will have to retire. How do people make that decision to take their name off the search and rescue list? I'm guessing that's really hard.
So I can't really speak for anyone specifically on our team. I know there are many members who started Androscoggin Valley Search and Rescue who, like Bill himself, who called in. You know, they've been doing it for many, many years. And I think at some point, they just make that decision when they're ready, when they feel it's necessary. I know we're sort of in the process right now, as far as the board of directors of Androscoggin Valley. We're trying to get people that are part of the younger generation that are guides around town, and get them part of the shakedown teams that, you know, are preparing the newest hikers and members and outdoor enthusiasts of our team to be part of the winter teams, the winter above, the winter below, the three season. And we're kind of coaching people along. And then when it's ready to pass the torch, those older members of ours can pass the torch when they feel it's time.
What's the shakedown team?
So we have a shakedown committee, and a shakedown is what we refer to as the first test hike with the team. So we have multiple different team levels. We have winter above, winter below, and then a three season for our members. So if you're someone who has no interest in being in avalanche terrain, or doesn't have the equipment, or isn't really someone who has a lot of mountaineering skills, then typically you would be on the three season team. And then there's winter below, so you would still have somewhat of a mountaineering technique or skill that you would be a part of, but you would just stay below the trees during any sort of winter calls.
Wow, so it's very specific in terms of your comfort level and your skill level.
Yeah, and we make it that way. I know according to the U.S. Forest Service, it is a requirement to have a beacon probe and shovel if you are going to be out in avalanche terrain. So we do require that for all of our winter above team members as well.
I want to bring another voice into our conversation. With us now on the line is Joe Lacasse. He's public safety officer with the town of Waterville Valley and a drone hobbyist who was on hand for that Dilley Cliffs fire in Woodstock last year. And Joe, good to have you with us. Thank you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So how did you use your drone or drones to help firefighters with the Dilley Cliffs fire last year?
Last October, at the Dilley Cliff fire, I assisted Fire Command basically by providing aerial views of the fire. The fire chiefs were able to see live aerial footage from my drone as the fire progressed up the Dilley Hill Cliffs, and they were basically able to communicate with their people on the mountain and place assets in places that needed to be placed so that they could kind of get the fire under control, which unfortunately they weren't able to for, I think that fire burned for 36 days.
Yeah, so using that sort of drone's eye view, you were able to help them target their resources more effectively, Joe?
Yeah, I was able to actually follow their commands. They had certain areas that they wanted to see, so I could fly the drone into the hot spots and to areas where the wind was, you know, they could see which way the wind was blowing. They wanted to see what was in the path of the fire, and was able to provide a very good perspective of what was going on.
So given that experience, Joe, what are your thoughts about using drones to locate lost or injured hikers?
I think it's a phenomenal tool. The technology is changing so quickly, and it's improving. The use of thermal imaging and the high resolution photography that's available on the drones right now, really, you can the perspective from above just gives you so much more advantage, especially if you're having trouble finding someone.
So could a drone find somebody, for example, in like really foggy weather or really windy weather, or is its capability limited according to the weather?
Well, that is a problem, and the technology right now is starting to grow that can overcome that, such as the thermal imaging, the weather is actually a problem for a lot of at least the consumer level to mid-level professional drones, in that they can't really handle the rain, and with extremely high winds, they do have some trouble. But that's actually changing quickly. There's a couple of drones out there that are extremely weather resistant, have very powerful thermal imaging that you would be able to spot a person through foliage or, you know, thick smoke.
So thermal imaging is like the warmth that your body gives off. Is that what you mean by that, Joe?
It does. It takes a differential between your body temperature compared to your surrounding temperature, and it'll pick out the high points. So it'll show a warm spot or a cold spot, and you can basically pick someone up from that.
So how would it know the difference between me and a bear?
It probably wouldn't, other than the shape,
So this is really interesting. I just want to ask you two more questions, if I could. Joe, if it was too dangerous for rescuers to go in, but that your drone did locate me, could you drop me a flashlight or a sleeping bag or a granola bar? I mean, can drones do that?
Well, right now in Waterville, we have a prototype. One of my drones we've modified so that we're waiting for the situation to come up. It's actually very common. Last summer, I think we had several of these situations where people go hiking and they only bring a cell phone and so they don't have a flashlight, they don't have any warm clothes or anything like that. And then all of a sudden it gets dark and they can't see the trail to come back down. And we very often hike up with a flashlight and provide them with a flashlight. And we're waiting for the next scenario where we can, this drone is set up to drop a flashlight and a thermal blanket.
Wow.
And if they can just flash a flashlight up so that we can see where they are, we can fly the drone to them. Or if I have a good GPS signal, I can figure out where they are.
Well, it's interesting. Sandy said earlier, one of the biggest mistakes he sees frequently is no headlamp to get out at night. So
that's the number one problem. It happens so often up here because we have four, right in Waterville Valley, we have four 4,000 footers. And so people come here to hike them all the time. And some people think it's, you know, they'll leave at 5 o'clock for a day hike and it gets dark before they can get back, and then they become trapped on the mountain.
Well, last question for you, Joe. We talked earlier with Samantha and Sandy about how some people feel like New Hampshire's excellent search and rescue operations make some hikers feel overconfident. You know, hey, if something happens, you know, they'll come get me, they'll fly the helicopter in, whatever. So would the drones exacerbate that attitude of, you know, I can be careless because the drone's going to drop me a flashlight?
I certainly hope not. You can't not rescue people when they're in distress, and so I really don't know what people are thinking. I see a lot of good public PSAs out there to tell people to, you know, dress warm. But I mean, a lot of times I'm at the trailheads and I see people in flip flops and, you know, no backpack, one bottle of water and a cell phone, you know, and they're leaving at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and you're like, oh
wow,
I'm going to get a call later today.
Yeah.
You know, and you try to talk to them, and they're like, oh, no, we're just going to go up halfway. I'm like, okay.
Yeah. Well, Joe, it's really good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Joe Lacasse, public safety officer with the town of Waterville Valley. And as he told us, a drone hobbyist who's been thinking about the possible use of drones in terms of search and rescue in the White Mountains. What do you think about this, Sandy?
I think that it, given limited use, I think drones can be really useful. They can, if they can drop headlamps and they can locate people who are lost so that when Samantha goes out, she knows exactly where she's going with her team, I think that can be great. I think if we infest our air with drones so they're flying all over the place, and I think that would compromise the wilderness to the point where I'm not sure I'd want to be there.
Takes away from that wilderness experience to have a drone buzzing over your head.
It does.
All right. Well, let's go back to our listeners. Mary's calling from Nashua. Hi, Mary. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you. I'm concerned about the personal locator beacons. I recently purchased an ACR Rescue Link Plus. It doesn't have settings. It has a GPS in it. There's nothing. The fact it comes in from the factory, you don't do anything other than register it. Have I wasted my money? I'm listening to what you have been saying on the air, and I have been hiking a long time, and I do have most of those preparations ahead of time, but I do hike solo, and I'm also a ham radio operator, so I'm able to contact people for the most part. I mean, there are cases where my signal can't get out, but
sure.
In general, I do. But this was my emergency. All else failed.
Well, and especially if you're hiking solo, Mary, so I hear you on that. What do you think, Samantha?
I would highly encourage always a backup. That's just my opinion on that. And no, I don't think you've wasted your money. The key where I was kind of going with making sure that it's out of the factory settings, making sure just knowing exactly the device that you've purchased, knowing and understanding how it works, how it operates, so that if you ever do have to use it or make that phone call, know how to look up your coordinates so that you can actually give them to New Hampshire Fish and Game so that they don't have to walk you through it. Those are the key importance to having those backup devices. So no, I don't think it was a waste of money. I think it's a great investment, and it is worth having that emergency backup if for some reason your map blows away or you're disoriented and you can't read a map because you're hypothermic or in situations like that. So,
all right. Well, if your water bottle spills on your map and it gets all wet and unreadable. Mary, thank you so much for the call. Lots of great emails are still coming in. Here's one from Dennis in Barrington. Another valuable resource to utilize in planning a hike are websites with recent reports on trail conditions from other hikers. Dennis says an example is newenglandtrailconditions.com. He says this can be especially valuable in the spring to know whether to anticipate ice on the trail that can last considerably longer than many expect. In fact, Sandy, in your book, there's a story about a couple experienced hikers who ran into ice in June. So thank you, Dennis, for that. Here's one from Katie who says, I was a trail and ledge steward at Welch Dickey a few years ago. And because it is advertised as an easy hike, people tend not to be prepared for the whole hike. They would bring a single bottle of water for a whole family. Wow. They would not listen to my advice to not continue up exposed faces when it's raining because they are slippery. And then I would see them 40 minutes later telling me I was right. Katie says the stewards are there to help and only want to give the appropriate advice to get you through your hike safely. I always tell them that the mountain will be there tomorrow. So, Katie, thank you for that one. Here's another one that, boy, we could do a whole hour on this, but I'm going to throw it to you, Sandy. Can your guests comment, Rick asks, on who pays for search and rescue? This has been a big, big deal in recent years.
It's a complicated answer. Right now, the primary budget that is used for search and rescue is New Hampshire Fish and Game's Law Enforcement Division. It's around a $300,000 budget a year. Samantha's group and Pemigewasset Valley Search and Rescue are volunteer groups, and so they incur expenses sometimes for equipment, and sometimes they get help from the New Hampshire Outdoor Council. But the money comes from New Hampshire Fish and Game. That's derived from license sales for fishing, hunting, and it's also derived from sales of a HikeSafe card. And
that's relatively new in the last 5, 6, 7 years.
Yeah, actually last couple years, 3 years, I think. The HikeSafe card is both a card that gives you an exemption from paying for a rescue as long as you're not negligent or reckless. And but it would be rare, frankly, to be charged for a rescue unless you were negligent or reckless. So it turns out to be more of a voluntary contribution to support search and rescue, and it's been very successful.
New Hampshire,
really? They've raised over $100,000. They closed their budget deficit with this card the year before last, and I think they continue to do well. Because it's a voluntary card, the worry is, will people buy it next year, and will people purchase it the year after? But it's a complicated question that many of the rescuers I talked with said it should be a simple question. It should be funded from the general fund, and the legislature should do this.
Yeah, we've done entire hours on this question, so I'm sort of sorry to throw that at you at the very end of this show. So here's an email from Jason that just came in. He says, I work at a shop that sells outdoor gear in the Mount Washington Valley. Local retailers, Jason says, are a good resource for not only gear, but current info. Everyone I work with are avid outdoors people. Jason says the glossy ads might get you into the mountains, but a local shop is a good resource for info on current conditions. Jason says, I'm heading into the woods as soon as your show is over. Jason, thank you for listening, and thank you for the email. And both of you, boy, there's a lot more we could have talked about. I really appreciate you coming in. Samantha, it was nice to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Samantha Brady, president of Androscoggin Valley Search and Rescue, manager of museum and retail operations at the Mount Washington Observatory. And Sandy Stott, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
Sandy Stott, author of Critical Hours, Search and Rescue in the White Mountains, also former editor and writer for the Appalachian Mountain Club's journal, Appalachia, and he's been the journal's accident editor. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.